Last week we sort of built a little pedestal upon which to stand man, and now we have to go to work on the image which is to surmount this pedestal. Let us then begin with one or two terms that we're going to need in principle, whether we refer to them often in words or not. In Indian philosophy, we have a term, jiva, J-I-V-A, which is an Eastern name to signify the universal life principle. Now, this universal life principle naturally exists in innumerable conditions, and it also exists unconditioned. The term jiva primarily relates to the unconditioned source of this life. In other words, the universal life principle itself, or eternal existence manifesting as infinite life. There is another term, prana, P-R-A-N-A, which is derived from the study of the principle of jiva. Prana corresponds essentially to the life energy or life agent operating on the level of a material creation. Therefore, it is a phase, an aspect, a condition of jiva. Prana may be likened perhaps to the sustaining vitality by which everything is nourished and maintained in a functioning condition. Without prana, it would be as though electricity was turned out of a circuit, or a whole group of machines dependent upon it were left without it. The entire mechanism of organic life would cease without prana. And the great problem that exists in nature is the distribution of this through the organisms of created things. Prana is obviously a degree of energy far more attenuated than physical matter. And everywhere in Eastern philosophy, we realize that irreconcilables do not suddenly come together. In order to bridge vibratory intervals, structures have to be created. Bridges have to be built. And in the case of man, these bridges are bodies, by means of which he is able to capture, hold, and distribute various conditions of the universal life around him. So most essential and immediate to the need of man is a vehicle or body called in the Indian languages Vilinga Sarira, by means of which prana or energy can be distributed not only to the physical economy of the human being, but also to sustain all other activities as emotion and thought. Actually, of course, it is not quite correct to say that one energy supports all of these. It is correct to say it in principle, just as we may say that jiva, or the eternal life, supports all living things. But energy, in order to be useful, must be conditioned or channeled, and must be variously modified in its functions in order to be assimilable to the various levels of activity. So man possesses a fourfold nature, and this fourfold nature must be nourished, must be kept in a constant state of vitality. Therefore, a fourfold bridge has to be created. And this fourfold bridge is composed of what the Western esotericist has termed the vital body. This is the body by which vitality is channeled. And the function of this body is obviously important to all of us. And wherever we have devitalization, we have obstruction in the motion of vital energy through the body. Now, when we recognize vital energy, we are easily convinced that it represents a principle of activity. And yet there is one phase of vital energy which apparently does not demonstrate activity as we know it, and depends for its definition upon molecular activity. That is, activity within itself. This particular form of energy we have termed, hypothetically, physical ether. Now, physical ether, or chemical ether, is possessed of one attribute by which it may be recognized. It is a principle which holds or binds things. Therefore, the primary function of this particular form of energy is that things shall have an existence in the material world. In other words, all of the minute particles, for example, which compose the body of man, are held together because of this hypothetical medium in which they are immersed, and by which the principle of cohesiveness is maintained. If this principle is withdrawn from a body, as occurs in death, the body slowly but inevitably disintegrates. Or if it is preserved, as in the case of the Egyptians, then this body gradually turns back to inorganic substance, becoming almost, as it were, a stone. Now, a stone, however, must also have some kind of etheric binder, otherwise it could not even exist. And every material structure exists because of a cement that holds the infinitesimal parts of it together. Now, in the case of the human being, the lowest manifestation of energy is this cohesiveness, this power which maintains and organizes structure, so that structure does not disintegrate. And this living substance must have an existence as a structural archetype prior to the formation of the physical body, because the body does not produce it. The body is merely dependent upon it. We told you last week that the body is not a principle. Therefore, that essentially it has no dimensional functions of its own. It is a receptacle of principles. It is therefore, first of all, held together by physical ether, which forms, so to say, the cement. And this cement keeps the structure in an appearance and in a type and in a kind. It also supplies certain nutrition to the minute particles of matter, which are not directly nourished by the ordinary methods of sustenance that we know. It is therefore a living material in which structure develops and grows. But the first and primary nature of it is unchanging. This etheric element, chemical ether, has no important changes in it during the lifetime of an individual. Its nature is not subject to change, because change represents another type of activity which this ether does not naturally possess. It is almost like a great sea which supports innumerable lives, but the bulk or substance of the sea is apparently eternal and unchangeable. We are further told in the Eastern philosophies that this material, if by any circumstance is destroyed or injured, that it may, to a measure, restore itself, but will leave scarification. This is therefore the actual reason why physical scars remain on the body, because the damage to the ether is never repaired completely. The flesh might grow together, but as the ether constitutes the archetype or the mold and determines the condition of matter, the etheric scar will remain and will result in its image or reflection upon the physical body. Now, we know, for example, that by surgery today, particularly plastic surgery, we can remove the visible signs of scars. But in the ether, the original scar is not changed, because this substance does not change. The old esotericists, including Paracelsus, pointed out that the ether is not subject to injury in very many ways, but that it is subject to injury by sharp instruments, and that cuts, or any injury caused by sharpness, will sever or injure the etheric structure, because it is so close to the physical that it responds to certain physical conditions. So this ether, then, must have a natural and proper vehicle for its manifestation. It is particularly and closely associated with the mineral life of nature, and therefore it is naturally associated with the mineral content of the human body. Its particular abode in man is in the marrow of the bones, and that is a reason why certain ailments or injuries which affect the marrow in the bones will ultimately lead to pernicious anemia, which is the loss of the contact of this ether. This ether, however, has tremendous recuperative power in the sense of continuance, because we have to remember that behind it is a tremendous universal energy field, and that this energy field, like all parts of nature, is striving constantly, instinctively, and perhaps without realizing the fact, but not because of conscious intent, because of inevitable circumstances, is constantly seeking perpetuation, preservation, the fulfillment of its own peculiar mission or purpose in existence. Now man, having a physical body that is held together by this etheric material, this becomes naturally the beginning of the study of the Linga Sharira in man. It is the beginning of the study of the vital principle, as this is manifested to him through means of what has been called the vital body. We must study, then, this body this evening and try to understand many of its peculiarities, its wonders, and its reasons for existence and its inevitable need in the compound of the individual. Man, consisting of certain superphysical attributes, powers, of which the most familiar to most of us is the mind. The mind, we know, is in some way associated with the brain. We know, however, that mind and brain are not identical. We know, consequently, that there must be a link between the mind and the brain. We also know that man possesses a powerful emotional nature, which extends from the highest and most sublime of spiritualized emotions to the most material propensities of kama or desire. We know also that emotions do not arise within the body, but are imposed upon it from the kama rupa or emotion body of man. That this body cannot have a direct contact with its material physical centers or its centers of distribution into objectivity. The third principle that we recognize in connection with man is a compound of several things. One of these, and the most basic, is motion. Another, almost equally basic and certainly as inevitable to the survival of man, is generation or reproduction. And we observe that these are introduced into the phenomenal life of nature in the plant kingdom. That the plant kingdom, while it does not usually possess the power of motion, except in the case of the sensitive plant and certain others, that it does possess the power of generation. Therefore, generation becomes one of the attributes of the second or vital etheric principle. The power to generate is not inherent in the physical body, and there could be no perpetuation of the species unless a vital principle of generation was united to the material structure of the body. There could be no emotion unless a vital principle or nutritional emotional agent united emotion to the physical emotional distribution centers. There could be no thought unless the mind was connected or bound to the body, the brain, by means of an emotional, by means of a vital field of energy. Thus we observe gradually that four vital fields are necessary in order to maintain the compound of man as we know him today. There is first the chemical field of vitality, by means of which the body is held together or kept into a unified structure. The second is the vital power to reproduce, to grow, to extend the body from one condition of its own development to another, as in the case of the tree which grows over a great period of time. The power also to have certain conscious or at least subconscious associations with the principle of life. But we know, for instance, that ivy planted in a dark place and separated from the light by a series of tortuous chambers or passageways will instinctively develop and grow through these twisting passageways until it finds the light. There is this principle, therefore, even in the plant kingdom, of this quest for direct contact with the source of vitality. The animal world, we have further development of motion and emotion. And we have many other interesting phenomena. We also find that the various kingdoms are so constituted that the vital axis of the body attunes them to energies moving in various directions in space. The ancients recognized certain motions. They believed, for example, that plant vitality was a vertical motion from below, that man was an inverted plant with his root in heaven or in the sky, and that his energy descended in a vertical line. That the animal, having a horizontal or nearly horizontal spine, his energies or vitality were related to a cyclic motion around the earth. And that the chemical or physical vital energy of the basic material substance had no direct motion of its own, but hung as a cloud or haze enveloping all physical things, a kind of haze such as we see in the early morning around the base of hills and things of that nature, something which is not subject to motion as we know it, but hangs and clings, holding things together, binding them into various structures. Thus, what we term the vital body of man is composed of these four kinds of energy, suitable for the distribution of various attributes and the sustenance of the physical body as such. The ancients also likened these streams of prana or energy to the four elements, declaring that the physical ether represented the earth, the vital principle of ether represented water, the emotional principle of ether fire, the mental principle of ether air. And they therefore have in India many curious charts showing the human body divided horizontally into levels or stratas distributed among these elements, with a fifth element called akasha at the crown of the head, which represented a synthetic agent, a power which held the other ethers within itself, and called in alchemy Azoth, or the mysterious agent of universal life. Now when we come to study the body, which is composed of these etheric energies and elements, we find that it is basically composed, as we might assume or imagine, from what we term physical ether or chemical ether itself, which now plays the part of a subtle kind of matter and becomes, more or less, the integrating principle of the etheric body. It is its bone, muscle, skin, tissue structure, comparatively invisible to us except under certain conditions. That this physical etheric vessel also becomes immediately the container of the superior etheric powers or principles. When seen together as one structure, the etheric body, as has been observed by Dr. Kilner in his work using the Kilner screens, the etheric body corresponds in appearance generally to an energy field. It may be observed most acutely through certain of its lower parts, which have the appearance almost of an electrical field. The etheric body extends beyond the physical construction of man, a distance of from 1.5 to 5 inches, and seems to surround the physical form with a luminous fur, This luminous fur consists of innumerable minute emanations which pass from the skin pores. And of course, these emanations do not come from all parts of the body. Actually, they originate in the nerve terminals. And wherever a nerve ends, there from the end of it is extending a very minute ray of energy. This ray of energy is also responsible for certain reactions. For we know that under some conditions, we can gain what might be apparently an almost miraculous ability to feel or to sense things a short distance from the body. Also, we may, under certain conditions, as in cases of mesmerism, find that these energy extensions can be used to affect the energy fields of other persons. Under very careful analysis, we know that the vital body is composed essentially of molecules, and that these molecular forms, very minute, are in a mysterious way associated with the body's physical cells, and that there is an etheric molecule associated with each physical cell of the body. This is the reason why the old Hindus affirmed that the etheric double was an exact duplicate of the physical body, because it corresponds molecule for molecule with all structure. The etheric body itself, being thus a field of emanation, if we study the emanations very carefully and systematically, we observe that these emanations are like some kind of falling water. Socrates, in describing or discussing the flowing of water, told his disciples to remember that what we call the flowing of water is the result of minute dry bodies moving across and with each other, tumbling over each other, but that each original unit was dry. He therefore essentially discovered something that we have not known until much later. In this emanation from the etheric body, or through the pores of the skin, we have therefore a perpetual emanation of what appears to be light, but which when carefully examined proves to be a stream of minute geometrical forms, almost like extremely tiny snowflakes. These represent molecular discharges of energy. And what we call electricity is actually composed of minute bodies, which because of their size and their rapidity of motion give the impression of being a continuous line of energy. These emanations from the body, surrounding it in all parts, emanating from every part of the surface of the skin, will also be observed to be in different number, density, and vitality in various parts of the body. Kilner was also able to discover this with his diocyanine screens. We know, for example, that certain parts of the body are much more energy radiant than others, and that these energy radiation areas correspond with certain symbolic structure within the body itself. We know, for instance, that where hair is denser from the body, the emanation fields are heaviest. And there is everything to cause us to suspect that what we call hair is very largely a growth or crystallization, a form of vegetation sustained by energy moving directly from the surface of the body, and therefore directing the general core of growth. The hair being a single tube-like structure which has been constructed around an energy field for a purpose. We also know that there are certain parts and extensions of the body, such as the hands, in which the amount of energy is greater than that in the larger body surfaces. We know also that each finger terminates in a particularly powerful vortex of etheric emanation. We know also that this emanation differs with the different fingers under various conditions. We know also that there are powerful centers in the palms of the hands and the soles of the feet, where in the old Buddhist and other mystical traditions, there were chakras painted, or symbols, wheels, or disks of energy. And these, into a measure, also correspond with the traditional wounds of Jesus, from which the energy for the salvation of men is said to flow. Of all parts of the body, three are most abundant in their energy fields. The least of these, but still very abundant, is the great solar plexus, or the what might be termed the sympathetic brain of the body. The solar plexus has tremendous importance, particularly on the level of vitality, or the perpetuation of the functions which are active in man. The physical or chemical form of ether does not move function, but the vital ether, which is centered largely in the great abdominal area, moves action and bestows upon all things both their will-led or their autonomic functions. Some functions are by conscious purpose, some like respiration and the beating of the heart are automatic. And all these functions, which have to do with the principle of animation and motion, are under this second etheric power. It is so located in general in the great solar plexus area and is closely associated with digestion and assimilation in the physical body. We will come back to this in a moment because it is the particular subject of the evening, but we want to pass on to a general resume of certain other points. The next most important of all the centers is the cranial area, or the brain. And in the brain, we have a tremendous exaggeration of etheric substance. Also an extraordinary differentiation and a breaking down of ether into sub-levels and sub-varieties and sub-vibratory notes, all within one grand octave, however. Because of the tremendous intensity of the etheric field around the brain, it is frequently represented as the nimbus or halo around the heads of sanctified persons. And of course we realize that the nimbus has been used in religious art by many peoples prior to Christianity, because wherever the individual or the mystic has had any extrasensory perception at all, he has become aware of the luminosity around the heads of persons in whom an extraordinary and remarkable degree of growth has been attained. The greatest of all, the most important of all these centers of vitality, however, and the one that must always and inevitably dominate, is the heart center. It is here that is located the Septapana cave of the Buddhist initiation, the seven-roomed house of man, or the cave with the seven chambers within it. Or as Tatian said to Hermes in his famous discourse, upon the diaphragm stands the pyramid of the Almighty, which is the heart. The heart, therefore, is actually the center of the entire objective life power of the individual. And it is from here that the most powerful and tenacious streams of energy are constantly moving. Also, the energy has interior motions, which we do not see. But wherever there is an internal function, there is a field of luminous energy in which it takes place. Because of the beating of the heart, the drum of Shiva, there must be, and is, a most constant luminosity, a powerful luminosity, surrounding the entire heart area. An Arab physicist, many centuries ago, attempting to analyze the source of life in man, performed various experiments upon animals, in one of which he exposed the heart in the living animal and touched the apex of the left ventricle with his finger. Immediately, it raised a blister. It burned his hand. Because, as he expressed it, there is a fire there, which is constantly burning. We do not know that it is hot, because the heat is diffused throughout the body. But if it is isolated, it becomes a tremendously powerful center of heat and energy. So we have these centers from which energy may flow in particular and peculiar abundance. Also, in cases of pregnancy, there is a tremendous energy activation around the uterus. And this can be seen extending sometimes a foot to 15 inches from the body, because a new life is developing and all of nature's energies are blazing forth in the integration of this structure. And there is no time in the life of the human being in which the energy fields are comparatively as powerful as before his birth, because they are busily engaged in accomplishing a purpose which has great and lasting significance. Now, we study these energy fields and we observe that they differ markedly with various individuals. We also know that they correspond in certain respects to a communication system. For example, if you stub your toe, there is an immediate change in the energy field of the pineal gland in the brain. and the pineal gland shows the injury or shows the discomfiture of this incident. If the individual puts his hand in hot water, which is unpleasantly hot, there is immediately a change in the magnetic field of the heart, the brain, and the generative system. All these are responding in various ways because each one has a job to do to get that man's hot hand out of the hot water. One type of energy must give him the power to take it out. Another type of energy must give him the understanding to know he must take it out. Another type of energy must convey the pain impression so that he will recognize discomfiture and attempt to prevent its continuance. So that it is not sufficient that any one energy alone be notified, or any center in the body be notified. The entire structure on various levels must be notified, because the correction of any immediate problem, the understanding of any subject, the accomplishment of any work or activity, means that vitality, emotion, and thought must all be equally alerted in order that each may take its proper part in the change which is projected, whatever that may be. In studying the adult, in the case of the magnetic fields, we come to a number of other important discoveries. We observe that these fields are very heavily influenced by emotion and thought and by the general condition of vitality. Obviously, the chemical or physical ether has no absolute demand upon the individual. It is not sustained by nutrition or anything else. It is sustained because it is part of the Earth's magnetic field. Therefore, he participates in it because his physical body is part of the Earth, must be nourished and sustained with it, and must be kept in order that the total physical factors of existence may be maintained. Immediately, however, above this level of the etheric energy, comes the second, which is the vital energy, which is particularly associated with the vitality of the individual in its most rudimentary and primary form, corresponding to the plant kingdom. This vitality must therefore be constantly replenished, and there is no way in which it can be replenished except by one or more of the means which nature has provided. The first and most important, of course, from the standpoint of universal availability, is air. And air, whether we realize it or not, is a constant and eternal vehicle of prana, or energy. And air is simply a field of pranic emanation, which has passed into a certain level, which we call physical air. But still, it is a constant and abundant source, not only of vitality, but of many other things. We know, for instance, now what our ancestors did not know, and that is that if you place air under sufficient compression, you can reduce it to a solid. And also, that if you can examine that solid afterwards, you will find in it practically everything that you find anywhere else in nature. In other words, it is perfectly conceivable that we can mine gold from the air. It is also perfectly conceivable that we could get petroleum from the air. It would be in very minute amounts, yes. Probably hardly profitable. But every element that exists in nature exists also in the air, including a number of very heavy precipitating materials which we know as smog, which perhaps are not absolutely essential to our survival. But air is a tremendous source of energy, and it is constantly washed in its natural way or natural manner by the sun. Now, recognizing air to be a carrier of ether, and recognizing it, therefore, as one of the life-giving agencies, we now discover another use of energy, and this brings up something which we might make a brief detour on. I hate to take the time, but I think it is important. And that, namely, that air is an invisible kind of water. It is an invisible kind because it is a degree more attenuated than water. But it has many of the attributes and qualities of water, in which, in fact, all ethers do. That is why etheric emanations can be most easily captured in frozen water, and we have the pictures on window panes. These pictures, incidentally, can be changed by the human will, if a man knows how to do it, because he can influence the etheric patterns. But ether, like water, is used in one of its functions for the regeneration of exhausted or polluted energy. The energy passing, for example, into man through respiration passes at the process of inhalation and becomes a source of vitality. Wastes, dead materials, are passed out of the lungs through exhalation and are returned again to the air, where subjected to light and to the pranic field, they are revitalized and passed through a kind of regeneration in which then the air is again suitable to be used. The same thing happens in water, and water will inevitably purify a certain amount of refuse material which may be entrusted to it. But if water is pressed beyond its absorbing, transforming, regenerating power, it then becomes polluted. And if it is polluted, it simply means that the amount of material entrusted to it for purification is greater than it can transform. Air has the same limitation. And it is very possible that one of the phases of our smog problem lies in the fact that our various activities are throwing into the atmosphere more material than the vital energies of the sun and the vital field of the earth can transform. Therefore, gradually, a pollutional factor is being built up. Now, as man is constantly emanating etheric streams from the body's surface, we know that these etheric streams form a kind of elimination. These were called in 18th century France, during the period of Dr. Mesmer's researches, an invisible perspiration, which again is a method of excretion, of sending out of the body certain materials which are not useful to it. If, therefore, the energy fields are depleted, the excretion through the etheric double is not complete, and we therefore begin to build up what we commonly know as toxins. Ether thus has this particular and important function, the function of purification, and the polluted material returning into the stream of pranic energy is reconverted and made again useful to the conscious needs of creatures. Also, there are creatures in nature which are able to contribute to this purification, for some forms of life live on energies which are destructive to other forms, and thus nature maintains a magnificent equilibrium in its process of preserving and purifying the streams of life that are needed for human survival. If we study the difference, for instance, between a healthy person and a sick person, we will observe immediately that this difference is marked in the vital emanations of the etheric body. The moment vitality, for one reason or another, is impeded or is obstructed within the body, we find this energy gradually fading out. The fur seems to fall limp against the surface of the body. The emanation retires until it merely encircles the body by an eighth or a quarter of an inch. Its color is faint, and even in the most vital parts of the body, there is a marked depletion, although this depletion cannot be complete or the body would die. We observe then that it is quite possible to diagnose a variety of ailments through the study of this etheric field. And gradually, through various types of electrical research and so on, we are discovering methods by means of which these emanations can be qualitatively and quantitatively measured. And through this measurement, we are able to understand them and prepare various remedies. Nutrition is another very important phase of our problem. Nutrition, however, is not the support of the body by means of the dead bodies of other things. We do not live upon forms. We live, rather, upon their energy fields. And we are nourished by anything that we eat merely because of its vital or etheric content. This etheric content restores or strengthens the etheric structure of the body of the individual. Thus, by food, we live not upon the form of the food, but upon its vitality principle. This was known in India, Egypt, and China long before the discovery of the so-called vitamin theory. But it is the vitality or the life principle of energy in things. Not the divine life principle, but the energy life principle, by means of which nutrition is possible. It is the gradual absorption of other energy into the body. Now, we know that the energies of other structures cannot be immediately incorporated into the human body. They must be introduced in small amounts, and they must gradually be overwhelmed by the energy field of the body itself. This is the reason why, under exhaustion, or under pressure, or under extreme nervousness, food does not digest. It means that the energies necessary to overwhelm or overcome the foreign etheric energy are not abundant. Gradually, however, in the process of etheric chemistry, the etheric body of the larger living being takes over the isolated etheric fragments of food, changes their vibratory rate to correspond to its own, and then is able to assimilate them into its energy field. This process is constantly going on in one way or another. Now, we know that wherever there is life, there is action. And we have two kinds of activity now that are associated directly with man's physical survival. One is the cohesive bodily energy, by means of which forms are held together, and the other is vitality, by means of which function is maintained. Now, these two represent a compound which can never be separated from man during the state of life. If man is ever separated from these two forms of energy, he will die. Therefore, it is not possible during the state of life for these energies to fail or falter, or the structures which support them to pass beyond a certain degree of desuetude without endangering total survival. Now, these are the two lower fields forming the lower half of the etheric structure. And above these are two other forms of ether. And the particular quality of these other two forms is that they are not merely radiant. Both of these other forms are empowered with motion. The two higher etheric structures are both movable. They both exist in a state of constant motion, not merely polar vibration. The lowest of these two higher etheric principles is the one which binds the emotional nature of the person to the emotional center of the body. And in simple fact, this emotional center is located in the apex, or in the great part of the liver. Therefore, the principle of emotion in man is distributed through the liver. Now, this does not mean that man's loves and hopes and fears originate in his liver. Let's not understand it that way. Remember, however, that between love and hate and fear and this physical body, there is an interval. The body does not hate. Hate has no body. The body does not love, and love, as the ancient Greeks said, is invisible forever. Therefore, the process of bringing emotions through into objectivity means that a method has to exist by which an abstract energy, in this case a psychic energy, the power of the soul, can come into the material form and be distributed through the nervous structure and also through the endocrine chain. To accomplish this end, therefore, a pole has to be established in the body, very much like the receiving set of a radio or television, which, unless it is appropriately attuned, will not be able to reproduce the message or the play or whatever is being broadcasted. Therefore, the liver forms this radio receiving set for emotional energy and causes the individual to experience in life the sense of feeling. To achieve this sense of feeling, the emotional energy which is associated with the liver, must distribute this emotional content which it carries within it, and for which it forms a vehicle or body throughout the system. And according to the old Hindu philosophy, this is done by way of the blood. Therefore, as Mephisto says in Faust, blood is a most peculiar essence. For blood is the symbol in ancient times of the soul. It is the symbol also of man's emotional content. On the level of religion, we know the mystery of the cleansing blood. On all symbol levels, we realize the same thing. We know that the spear of Longinus the centurion pierced the liver of Christ. We know also that Prometheus, the ancient Greek light bearer, chained to the rocky crag of Mount Caucasus, was given a vulture to gnaw forever at his liver. The liver, therefore, from earliest times, has been associated with the distribution of emotional energy, and is the particular seat and center from which this energy is distributed and diffused throughout the sensitive areas of man's sympathetic nervous system and through the chakras or the nerve centers of the body. Now, as this occurs in connection with the emotional ether, we know that this ether carries with it a number of important functions, one of which is to maintain sensory perception. We know that also it sustains the cycle of the skandhas, or these interrelated attributes by means of which the individual becomes conscious of himself as a being. These are the intensities. These are the attributes, the roots of selfishness and selflessness, of passion and compassion. And by means of these, the physical body is able to interpret the emotional degree of maturity attained by the entity or the person in the body. This further gives us understanding why it is that emotional content will affect physical health. We know that when emotional intensity strikes the etheric field, which must distribute this intensity, that certain results are inevitable. This field may and should exist, much like a pleasant afternoon in spring. It should be placid. The energy itself should be moving graciously and gracefully in the cycles which are natural to it. But about this time, the individual, as a person, becomes angry. Immediately, a storm breaks in the etheric field. This storm can be accompanied by all the traditional thunder and lightning that is involved in a tempest. Not in a teapot, in this case, but in the lobe of the liver. Following an unusual display, therefore, of temperament, there is an inevitable exhaustion in the energy field. The energy field reacts by a powerful opposition, and that which was previously superabundant suddenly appears as privated. The emotional energies have been wasted, have been lost and willfully expended, resulting in emotional depletion and very often accompanying fatigue and, of course, a very definite effect upon the heart and the heartbeat. The polygraph or lie detector has shown us, for example, that every emotion of the individual results in irregularities or changes in the heartbeat. Thus, the individual whose emotional intensities as a person are forced, these emotional tensions or abnormalities are forced into the physical structure, into manifestation, where they will result in the shouting, the screaming, the stamping of the feet, the angry looks, and all the other physical phenomena. That this transmission of emotion into physical symbolism is accompanied along a road of ether, and that these emotional intensities have a tendency to destroy or at least to limit or restrict the normal functions of this etheric binder. And without this binder, the individual is without emotional or color content. And therefore, it is very important to him that he maintain this function in as orderly a manner as possible. The next and highest of the four ethers which go together to make the compound which we call man is the mental ether. This is the bridge which links the individual as a person with the brain structure. The brain is therefore an extension of the mind. And the development of the brain is only possible because of the integrated power of the mind behind it. But brain is a material thing, mind is a supermaterial thing. And these, like the East and West, are the twain that cannot meet. The only way they can be brought together is through this bridge of ether, which participates of the qualities of both in a middle ground. Consequently, all thought moving into expression must move across this etheric bridge and becoming thereby transmitted to the conscious centers within the brain, or the consciousness centers within the brain, will then be distributed as an experience, as an awareness, or as a realization, a thought, or an idea. Now, all these thoughts and ideas not only have to come from the mind into the brain, but the moment this transference takes place, the brain is placed at a disadvantage. We must realize that we use the brain to think with, but the brain is not equipped for a continuity of thought processes. It requires 8 or 10 times as much energy to think as it does to feel. And it requires many times as much energy to feel as to act. Physical action, though the most strenuous, requires the least amount of energy. The reason being that it requires a grosser form of energy. Action can be maintained by a crude oil level of energy, but thought only by the finest ethyl product. Therefore, the process of refining energy makes it more valuable, makes it more difficult to secure, and makes it a more serious thing to waste. Mental energy, therefore, is much more subtle and a great deal more energy as prana or life force must be distilled to secure that which is necessary for thought process. Thought process also very quickly fatigues its own channels, and in a comparatively short time, the brain, under too much thought activity, begins to show acute fatigue symptoms. Thus, we know that constant activity is not possible to the physical body because it is not constituted to carry such a load. It must therefore have appropriate periods of rest. Now, in appropriate periods of rest, we have what we call the sleep habit. Now, there have been a great many discussions, in fact, we have talked about what is sleep. Actually, sleep, of course, represents a rise of toxin due to fatigue. It means that the individual has exhausted the available energies of a certain field of life activity. Therefore, he has also torn down a certain amount of structure, just as an electric light bulb, every time we turn it on, takes a certain amount of wear. And every so many hundred hours, we know that light bulb will be finished. We have to get a new one. Now, man, unfortunately, cannot so conveniently get a new body. Therefore, it is the same thing as with the light bulb or the radio tube. We try to lengthen its life by only using it at periodic intervals. We give it as much possibility of rest as we can, realizing that by so doing, we extend the total span of its facility. We probably don't actually extend the life of the bulb, but we do use it only when we need it. Therefore, it does not require replacement as often. Sleep, then, must be a period in which stress or strain, which is always the result of two qualities that are not completely harmonious, working in a compound or in an interaction. Compounds are the basis of friction. Friction causes wear and tear, and wear and tear ultimately depletes structure. Wherever two modes of energy work together, there is wear and tear. Therefore, whenever a thought arises in the brain, there is wear and tear to the brain. Not essentially to the thought, because it is above matter, and matter is where wear and tear lies. It means, then, that in order to permit reconstruction carried on by the physical ether and the vital or fluidic ether, to restore damage, to rebuild, reactivate, revitalize cellular life, to impart new molecular energy to cellular structure, that there has to be a period in which activity ceases, and recuperation or reconstruction is the primary purpose. Now we know, for example, that the emotional and mental ethers, or those energies which sustain feeling and thought, are eternally restless. And in Indian philosophy, we are told that there can be no recuperation on the mental and emotional level unless these ethers temporarily break contact with physical structure. In other words, as they would put it, these ethers simply cease active function. They become dormant, or almost completely so, retaining only a sufficient bond with the body to preserve the life, the continuity of faculty and feeling. Thus it was said in ancient times that in sleep these ethers simply departed. They left. And therefore the individual was without emotional or mental energization. The departure comes with the process of going to sleep. And when these energies are reestablished, the individual awakes. This means, however, that the etheric structure must be divided into two parts, one of which is capable of being separated from function without danger. The other cannot be. That part of the etheric structure which vitalizes function and maintains structure cannot be separated from the body. Therefore, the two higher etheric instruments are said to be separable. That is, they can depart or return. The rest, our lower ethers, however, must remain constant during life. These four ethers, then, constitute the four bridges, and they form together what we term the vital body. They are bridges upon which traffic moves in several directions. This traffic may move either from the person to the body, or from the body to the person. One is action and the other is reaction. Now the ethers moving from the person to the body carry with them the energized activities of the person. Those returning from the body to the individual or to the individuality behind it carry also certain messages. These messages being primarily the results of sensory orientation in the material world. Thus we know that one of the functions of ether is to convey the sensory findings of the individual to the centers in which these findings can be evaluated.